Accession number 9826, Reel 1.
Mr. Misseldine, Reel 1. Where were you born, Mr. Misseldine?
I was born in London, Islington, North London.
In which year?
In 1922.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a manager of with Charrington's, the coal merchants.
Mm-hmm. And where were you educated?
I was educated at Harrow, the Harrow County School, until the age of 15.
What job did you take up on leaving?
On leaving, I became a clerk, and was a clerk until 1940. That is, from 1937 until 1940.
Was that when you joined the RAF?
Yes.
Why did you decide to join, or were you called up?
I wasn't called up. I volunteered at the age of 18, on my 18th birthday, to be exact. I think the catalyst to my joining up was the fact that my brother was in the army, and he had gained a quick promotion to sergeant, and I found that when he came home on leave, that all of this conversation was about Jeff, and I felt I had to do something, and with my friends particularly, there was only one thing to do in those days, and that was to try and get into the Air Force. It was the glamour service at that particular moment in time.
Which month did you join?
I joined up at the end of September in 1940, which was my 18th birthday.
So this was in the middle of the Battle of Britain?
In the middle of the Battle of Britain, yeah.
Did you see anything of the Battle of Britain?
Yes, I was at that time working on the in West London, and from the site where I was working, it was possible to see many of the battles that were taking place over West London. And of course that in itself was exciting to an 18-year-old.
What did it actually look like?
Well, you couldn't see an awful lot because most of it was taking place fairly high up. You could see many vapour trails and sounds of machine gun fire, but you couldn't see any detail. But it occasionally you saw an aircraft come down. And as I say, from an 18-year-old, it was glamorous. One didn't realise at the time that it was a sort of very serious event.
Could you distinguish the nationality of the aircraft?
No, the only time I ever distinguished the nationality of an aircraft was in Harrow, that one Sunday morning coming back from church, I heard the sound of an aircraft flying low and looked up, and I suppose at an altitude of not much more than 200 to 300 feet, I saw the swastikas of a Hun Corps passing overhead, which was quite a thing. It's amazing the sort of reaction it had on you. And I think my reaction at the time was that he's flying very low, he's heading for Harrow on the hill, hopefully he's going to crash into the hill. But,
so you saw the Battle of Britain over Harrow, did you?
No, as much as anything, it was over Kensal Green. Harrow didn't see an awful lot of combat over it. The sort of location of Harrow being northwest of London, it wasn't on the flight path of aircraft coming in to bomb London.
Well, in what kind of numbers were the aircraft in the sky during the Battle of Britain? In dozens or what?
I suppose one can say in dozens. One's eyes really focused on one particular area where you could see perhaps the vapour trails going round and round, and you could hear the machine gun fire, and you sort of were with the pilots at that particular moment on that particular area, rather than taking a total general view. I think from I should say actually that at the outbreak of war, when I was just before my 17th birthday, that I joined the LDV, which later became, that's the local defence volunteers, which later became the Home Guard, and that until the time I joined up, I was a company runner tearing around on my bicycle taking messages to the home guards at different points. And so being, I was very often out in the evenings and nights, and I do recollect the glow on the horizon when London was being bombed, particularly in 1940, just about the time of the Battle of Britain, and seeing this glow against the clouds and realizing something was serious, that not ever going up to London to see what damage there was.
Did you feel confident that the RAF would win the Battle of Britain?
Oh yes, I think that at the time that France fell, it was a tremendous shock, and one had a feeling of being alone. But I think it was the words of Churchill which were so impressive to a youngster, that the British could never be beaten, which made you feel that this was so. At that time, of course, one was totally unaware of the odds that were against us at the time. One didn't know how disorganized the country was so far as arms were concerned. One didn't know about the arrangements that Churchill and Roosevelt were making to try and cover certain gaps, except for the fact of the purchase of the 50 old destroyers. And at a later time, which we'll come to in a moment, the background help that the Americans were giving clandestinely, even though they were supposed to be for that at the time.
Did you believe the statistics which are issued about the German losses during the Battle of Britain?
Oh yes, yes. I think that one didn't even question it. It may have been a sort of defensive viewpoint that you didn't want to believe anything else but the fact that we were doing well.
Was it easy to get into the RAF?
I found it quite easy. The sort of situation leading up to it was, as I mentioned before, this question of my brother in the army. And I was very, very friendly with a fellow called Stan Stillwell. And we both of us felt that we were going to join up in the RAF. He was about my age. And on my birthday, we went along. As a matter of fact, we went along in the beginning of September, prior to my birthday, to volunteer. And I was told I was too young, but to come back in 2 weeks' time. At that time, I couldn't see that 2 weeks was going to make very much difference to my abilities. But nevertheless, that was the situation. So we went back and volunteered, filled in the necessary forms, and went home and waited. And then towards the end of September, we got a letter asking us to report to Uxbridge. On arriving at Uxbridge, we found that there were probably 40 applicants in this particular batch, most of them in their 20s, some of them being conscripts, and quite astonishingly, quite a number of policemen who were very fit and seemed tremendous guys, and looking at them as an 18-year-old, one felt that one didn't stand much chance of getting in. However, I mean, I was very fit myself. I played a lot of sport. I even ran at White City at one occasion. Medical was no problem. And then we went for the educational interview, if you like. Now, prior to going up there, Stan and I had sat down and said, now, what would be useful in being a pilot? And we pinpointed one of the factors, and that navigation would be part of a job of a pilot or a navigator, because at that time we didn't know whether we'd get accepted as a pilot or whether we would have to take another role. So we ginned up on our trigonometry, which we felt that would be useful insofar as navigation is concerned. You have to set off wind and etc., etc. When we went through to our examinations, we passed with flying colours, both of us. And we were quite astonished to see the was probably a 60% rejection rate, including some of these hulking, ultra-fit people. So that in itself was, to us, a fillip to our ambitions. We were then interviewed by the air officer commanding at Uxbridge, who posed a lot of questions concerning our desire to get into the flying world. And at the end of the interview, I was asked if I wanted immediate service or deferred service. You may recall that in those days, anybody who was called up could apply for deferment for up to 3 to 6 months, which in many cases was probably necessary in order that they could tie up their family affairs or business affairs or things like that. Insofar as I was a lowly clerk, if you like, it was not necessary for me to have any deferment. So I said no, immediate service. I was then instructed to go and see the station warrant officer. I saw the station warrant officer and was attested, which was virtually signing on. And he said, I presume you want to go home to clear up your affairs. So I said, yes, 7 days are due me. And he said, well, I'm very sorry, 48 hours is all you're going to get. Now, I should mention that though my parents had realised that I was going over to apply to join the RAF, they weren't very serious about it. They thought RAF was top of the tree type of thing. John won't get in. So this happened to be a Saturday morning when the attestation took place, and I was then told to report back on Monday. So when I arrived home on the Saturday, father and mother were there, and they said, well, how did you get on? I said, all right. They said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I've been accepted for training as a pilot. So the father said, oh, well, he said, you've got 3 or 6 months before they'll call you up. I said, well, I'm awfully sorry, but I'm in on Monday. This in itself must have been a terrible shock to my parents at the time. As a youngster, one didn't realise it, but now, as a parent, one realises more the reactions of what children would do so far as your own feelings were concerned. So there we were, and I reported to Uxbridge and was given posting to I was posted to Wilmslow, which was really a distribution centre, and within 48 hours I was sent to Blackpool for initial training. This was marching up and down, learning to use rifles and generally indoctrinating you into the ground duties of being in the RAF. It should be remembered that when you volunteer to be a pilot, you are classified as pilot under training GD, which meant that you could be put on ground duties or you could be trained. It gave them the option of doing what they wanted with you. After 6 weeks training at Blackpool, I was posted to Babbicombe, which was an initial training wing where we got down to the serious business of starting studies on the various skills related to flying. This is certain basic navigation, certain basic signals, a little bit of theory of flight, and then an examination to test to see what absorption you had on the complexities of flying. This being concluded and passing out there, I went home on leave. And the next thing which would now have taken us to, I suppose this would have been about April 1941. Oh, I forgot to mention one period, yes. After I left Blackpool, I wasn't posted direct to Torquay, I was posted to Jerby in the Isle of Man.
Jerby?
Yes.
How do you spell that?
J-U-R-B-Y. That's in the north of the Isle of Man, where they had a big aerodrome with Hampden and one or two other aircraft. And for 3 months during the winter, I was on guard duty, guarding these aircraft against invasion. And I must admit, during that period of time, the thoughts of flying seemed to be receding further and further into the distance. So that, actually, I was posted to
Babbacombe,
near Torquay. It would have been then about March. So having concluded the 6 weeks course, it would have taken me to early May. As I say, then I went home on leave, and eventually, after some 10 days, I got a signal or a telegram asking me to report to Wilmslow again. I reported to Wilmslow. I was instructed that I was going overseas for flying training. I was given £5 in cash and told to go and buy a civilian outfit. So having bought a sports jacket and trousers, which one can get in those days for less than £5, I reported back to Wilmslow. There, we were told that we were going overseas and that we'd be issued with tropical kit. So our immediate thoughts were, well, we're going to Rhodesia, which was then a training ground for pilots. However, we were put on a train. When I say we, it was a batch of 100 of us, all in civilian clothes. We were put on a train and went to Glenock, where we boarded a ship which was called the Manxman. The Manxman was a very fast craft. I believe could achieve something like 25 knots. So we left the Clyde and turned north and eventually landed in Iceland. So we were a little bit confused about the whole of this thing, because Rhodesia was exactly in the opposite direction. There we stayed for perhaps 10 days in a camp at Reykjavik. I'll leave you to look the spelling up. Then we came back to the port again and were shipped on to a liner, a smallish liner called the Circassia, C-I-R-C-A-S-S-I-A, as far as I recall, which was probably more in the terms of an armed merchantman. It had Beaufort's gun on the rear, and on the stern, and one or two other machine guns distributed around the top. So we set off going westwards, and we changed course an awful lot, and eventually seemed to get into the area of icebergs. And in fact, on a couple of occasions, one heard the grinding of icebergs against the side of the ship. One or two of them, quite hefty bangs. But eventually, we arrived in Newfoundland. By then, we began to realise that we were going over that side of the water, and we put two and two together and presumed we were going into the United States of America, which was then still at peace with the world. It subsequently transpired that The reason for our deviation in that crossing and going further and further north was that it was at the moment the Bismarck was out and was in that area of the country and was being chased by the RAF Navy. And backtracking after the war, we discovered we must have crossed this path by less than 12 hours, and had we done so, we wouldn't be talking now. At Newfoundland, we were in train and went through to Toronto. There we disembarked and were spent 24 hours in Toronto. And the following morning we entrained again, crossed over near Niagara, and continued on this train for 3 days, wondering where the heck we were getting to. I must admit that American trains at that time were very luxurious. And we eventually stopped at Los Angeles. At Los Angeles we were met by the press, and they made a great big hoo-ha about the boys in blue arriving from Britain. And of course such was the distortion in those days that we were the Battle of Britain pilots, even though we had only come out there to learn to fly. We were then billeted at an old nightclub at Glendale. Glendale had a small airport there at that time. And we did one or two circuits at Glendale, but because it was a very busy airport. Incidentally, when we were at Toronto, the group was split into two groups of 50. 50 of us went to Los Angeles, and 50 went to Miami in Florida. We were very fortunate because ours was a created civilian flying school. In other words, they had got some 20 pilots who were the old barnstormers who used to do their exhibitions up and down the country, with probably hundreds of hours of flying and plenty of experience at the back of them. They were led by a major who was, or an ex-major, who obviously had been trained militarily, and therefore the course was designed around the American formation of their pilots. We used to go out by bus to an airfield some 20 or 30 miles outside of Los Angeles, and it was there we did our flying training, our first solos. It then became obvious that the airfield wasn't adequate for full-scale training, and the Americans, in the first 6 weeks of us being over there, built a complete airfield, including all the buildings required, laying down the runway at a place called Lancaster, which is on the Mojave Desert, which, oddly enough, is not very far from the area where they do all of their flights to the moon, etc. There we carried on our flying training. In the early days it didn't seem to go very well, mainly because there was slight difference in the attitude between the American way of thinking and the British. We react more to encouragement. It would appear that the American method of training is to be strong and firm with people, so that you'd be flying along in a spearman. We learned to fly in spearmen. You'd be flying along and thinking you're doing well, and suddenly the joystick between your knees would bang your knees because the instructor at the back wasn't very happy, so he used to waggle the stick to be more positive with you. We all found this problem, And so eventually one day we dreamt up the idea that we'd have a party with the instructors. So we had a party with the instructors one evening, and everybody had a fair old bit to drink. And then we laid into the instructors the things they can and cannot do with the British personnel, that they get far better results if they calm down a bit and coerced us along rather than driving us along. To their credit, they took this comment with good heart, and we found that our instruction then became much more amenable, and in consequence we had the astounding figures of 50 of the 50 people going solo. In other words, we didn't have one failure at that point. I think this was pushed to its extreme by the instructors in the hope of getting this 100% mark to justify their existence. Subsequently, one or two fell out as the course advanced, because they weren't genuinely pilots, but they'd just been forced through into a situation. Most of those were posted back to Canada and took part in navigational courses and became navigators. The course continued until October, the end of October in 1941, by which time I had completed 150 hours flying, of which 88 hours had been solo.
You said those other chaps weren't pilots. What do you think were the qualities needed for a battle pilot?
I think their problem, which is the problem of pilots, irrespective of whether it's battle or ordinary pilots, it's a question of coordination between the arms and the legs, particularly as in many manoeuvres you're using the arms with hands with the joystick, moving it in one particular direction, and you have to coordinate with your feet to hold the plane in a particular attitude. And this is particularly so if you're doing a roll, that you go through the phase of holding the wing up with your feet, turning it over, reversing the stick when you're upside down, and then doing the opposite as you turn through the rest of the roll. And I think that a roll is probably one of the most significant maneuvers in flying to test whether a person has coordination or not. And it's pretty obvious that when you get into aerial combat, you've got to have total coordination in order to keep your aircraft in the right attitude. For instance, if you are firing guns and you have got right rudder on, the trajectory of the bullets won't be in a straight line relative to the aircraft, so that you would obviously miss under those circumstances. So we had got to at the end of October, the 150 hours flying, where we were awarded our wings. We were then told that in view of the fact that we had been good ambassadors in America, that we would all go back to England and be commissioned and posted to squadrons after a conversion course onto fighter aircraft. So that early in November we came back to the UK, and we had a period of leave, and then I was posted down to Hillabington, where we did a transition course. Now, the transition course was mooted because we had flown American-type aircraft, which have certain characteristics.